So I think we can start. The door is not moving anymore. So, I'm Alyosha Kretek, and this session is about Apache Flink and IoT and what is my take, what a stream processing system needs to provide for IoT use cases. And basically what I'd like to talk about is what IoT use cases look like from a systems perspective. And we've heard a lot of stuff about IoT, about how to get the data from the devices into your system, how to do processing in the edge, and so on. But what I'm focusing on here is mostly you already have collected your data. It is sitting in some message broker or some message queue, for example, Kafka. And I'm going to talk about the perspective or the system that does the processing of this data in this message queue. Oh man, I've got some. Okay. Come in, please. So as I said, that's the perspective that I'm going to talk about. And I have a certain claim, we will get to that in a second, for what a system needs to provide for processing these IoT use cases in a nutshell. Then I also want to talk about stateful event time stream processing. We will soon see why this is necessary, and we will also, I'm sure you've heard the event time a couple of times now, but I want to look at it again from my perspective and give you some ideas, because this is not a conference about stream processing, so some people have might have not heard that before. And then in the end, I also want to talk about Apache Flink and why I think it's a good fit for IoT use cases. And in the presentation, so you won't see me talking about Flink a lot, which might seem a bit weird, because I want to talk in general about the requirements of such a system and the terms, and give you, if you will, a tool set for thinking about stuff and for analyzing a system, so that you can figure out for yourself when you look at a use case that you can try and make some decisions, basically. That's the idea behind it. But all the stuff I'm going to talk about, you can bet that Flink is good at this. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking about it, basically. But yeah. So I'm working at Data Artisans. It's a startup in Berlin. It employs some of the original creators of Flink, and we provide the DA platform, which is basically Flink with support on top. But yeah, that's it. So let's look at some IoT use cases and try and figure out what the basic requirements are of a system when you are processing data from these use cases. And this will seem quite repetitive, and I might seem lazy because all the slides might seem the same, but all my basic claim is that all these cases have a few basic requirements that the system needs to have. So let's look at a first use case in IoT is operations and manufacturing. So think about, we've heard about today, about operating wind turbines, where you get a lot of sensor data and you want to monitor these wind turbines, or manufacturing, where you have a factory, you have all these factory lines, you're producing cars, you have all these machines producing sensor data. And the important thing is here, if you are processing this data and you got all these we call them events, it's basically data produced by these sensors. If you process this event, you cannot look at this event in isolation, but you need to know about the past readings from this sensor. So for example, if you want to detect an anomaly, you need to know what is anomalous. So if you just look at an event in isolation, you don't know what the default or what is non-anomalous. That's why you need to have past readings when processing new events. And also an important thing to consider here that is that these events, they might not be immediately delivered to the system that does the processing. So there can be delays in how they're transmitted because of network outages and so on. And an important thing here is that these events, they usually have timestamps associated with them, which say when this event occurred, because it is important when you're doing analyses to find correlations across time or how stuff developed over time. So time is an important thing. So here we see you need past readings and you need you have these events that have time and you need to consider this. Another example is mobile gaming, where you have all these companies, for example, there's Angry Birds or there's Candy Crush Saga. It's all these people playing these games on their phones, and these games, they produce a ton of data. Everything that the user does in this game is basically is sent to the company, and the company is trying to analyze this to make more money off the players. Maybe to analyze the behavior, see if they're struggling, then give them a special offer that they can pay for, of course. And here, the important thing is, again, you want these events that these games produce. If you want to analyze them, you need to know about the past events. Otherwise, they're meaningless. You cannot analyze user data or the user behavior only makes sense if you know what the behavior is. You cannot do it with one event in isolation. And again, these events, they have timestamps, basically let's say when they are produced, when stuff occurred. And here again, especially in mobile gaming, if a user is playing and they are offline, then the game might buffer these events, and then later when they get offline again, when they get online again, it might send this data, so the data arrives with delay or might never arrive, and there's other problems. By now it's getting a bit repetitive, but another category is wearables, so all these Fitbits and Apple Watches and other tracking systems. Here again, if you want to analyze the events, you need to know the past activity, and again, the data has timestamps associated with them, which are important, and they can arrive with delay because these devices might be offline and so on. But now it's getting ridiculous, but automotive, another case where these cars, these engines, it's producing a ton of data, and when you want to analyze this, when you want to detect problems, you again need the past data. And again, cars might be offline, you might not receive the data when they are received, but with delays. There you have it. Now I'm just gonna solar power grid. You have devices monitoring the power grid. Again, they produce data, and again, there can be outages. And almost the last one, if you have network monitoring, so you're monitoring the internet devices or the mobile providers and so on, they have all these devices producing data. Again, if you want to detect stuff, you need to know past data, and stuff arrives with delay. And I promise this is the last one, because it's getting really repetitive. But it's an interesting case. It's mobile banking. Nowadays, banks, or some banks at least, that we're working with, they try to figure out what these people are doing, and then to analyze the behavior and then give special offers. For example, they might detect that a user is on a shopping spree, and then they can offer them a special line of credit, for example. Or fraud detection is an obvious case. Here you have all these transactions coming in, but to detect fraud, you need to know what is the normal behavior. So again, you need to know the past behavior, and again, time is important. So I've been talking about time a lot, so it's time for an interlude. I'm sure some people have heard about this. Can I get a quick show of hands? Who would say they know what event time versus processing time means? Okay, some people. So let's look at it from this mobile gaming example. So imagine there's a user playing on his phone. They don't have an internet connection, and the game is producing all these events. So every click, every win, every loss, every level advance, and so on, produces an event with a timestamp when that thing happened. But because they have no internet connection, the game simply logs these events for when the phone comes online again at some point, and only then, when they have a connection again, can the phone send all the data at once to the server, basically. And now, the thing is, you basically, these green bubbles, they are events, so they might, they contain some metadata, who the user is, what the user ID is, what they did, and so on. And the white number would be the timestamp when this event happened. And now what you might want to do is to figure out gaming sessions. So this user might have played a bit, then stopped again, then played a bit again. So you want to figure out what the playing sessions are, maybe why they stopped, maybe why they started playing, and so on. But the problem here is, so here on this axis you see basically processing time, and this is the wall clock time of the machine that is doing the processing. Basically the server sits there, then at one point it gets this whole burst of events that the phone sent when it came online again, and then if the machine simply considers the time when it got this data, the processing time, or sometimes we call it arrival time, and so on, and then basically say, okay, this is my gaming session because that's when the events happened, when I saw them, then this doesn't sound, or this doesn't look right, because it's just this whole blob of events. And the actual solution is this. So instead of considering the time, the capture time, the processing time when you receive this data, you want to look at the time that is in the data and use that for determining sessions or for thinking about time. And then what you actually see in this data is that there was a session that started around timestamp 1 there and went up until timestamp 8. And then fast forward, we have another playing session starting around timestamp 30 and then going until timestamp 40. And then only when we have this can we accurately figure out what was going on in that gaming session, basically. Why they stopped, maybe they were losing too much, and so on. And if we just looked at this one blob, we might not have seen these patterns. And that's basically the difference between processing time, the time when you process data, and event time, which is the time that is in the data itself. And some important vocabulary there is, as I said a few times, event time. It's basically the timestamp of an event when the event was produced. And event time processing is when a system that is processing this data is aware of these timestamps and takes them into account when processing. And another important, if we will, property of data is out of orderness. So often, I would say always, the events, they don't arrive in the order in which they are produced. So we saw this before. There was this whole blob of data that arrived at once with all these timestamps. And that's what we call out of orderness. And it's a problem if you don't consider it. And the sources of out of orderness, if you will, are network disconnects. So the phone goes offline. Then you get very big out of orderness, slow networks, and small out of orderness you get, so that's just maybe a few milliseconds back and forth, and the event that was produced before this event maybe arrives a bit later, and this just happens because you basically have distributed systems. There's a bit of delay between sending the data. You might be processing the data on a cluster of machines that all have slightly differing clocks. So basically everything that happens between this event being generated and the event being processed can introduce some out of orderness. And that's why you have to, that's why a system that you use for IoT processing needs to take this out of orderness and this event time stuff into account if you want to produce accurate results. And that's, I'm just showing this because it's funny, is a colleague of mine had this idea to think about processing time and event time. So on the bottom, you see basically processing time is the years when the Star Wars movies came out. And on top you see the event time because they arrived in 4, 5, 6, then came episode 1, 2, and 3, and then came episode 7. So that's basically a funny example to think about processing time and event time. So let's go back to the IoT use cases. And so my basic insights or claims about IoT use cases are that, of course, data is continuously produced, it never stops. That's why you need a stream processing system. all these cases, in all these cases, you need to keep track of past events. So the system has to have some facility for keeping, it's usually called state, data about the past events. So what you need is a stateful stream processing system. Another important bit is that these events, they have timestamps, and the timestamp is important. So you need to be, you need to have an event time aware stream processing system that takes this into account. And the important bit here is that data or the events, they usually don't arrive in order of the timestamps. So the system needs to take that into account. I quickly want to talk about the very generic concepts, basically, in stream processing, stateful stream processing, event-time stream processing. Still no Flink, if you're keeping track. So in very generic terms, stream processing is you have a stream of incoming data on the top that is never-ending, it's unbounded. You have some kind of computation that you want to compute on this incoming stream of data, and this computation produces some output, in this case the triangles. That's stream processing. Unbounded data in, some computation that you want to perform, like computing the mean or the average, and maybe detecting if an event falls outside of this mean or the standard deviation, and so on. Stream processing. Distributed stream processing is when you specify this computation and then you run it across a cluster of machines. Because the incoming stream has too high throughput for it to be handled by one machine, so you need a cluster of machines. And this is basically what all these Apache stream processing systems such as Storm, Samza, Spark Streaming, Flink, what they do distributed stream processing. They provide an interface basically to specify this computation, and then they make sure, or they take care of spreading this across a cluster. Then stateful stream processing is an extension of stream processing, so you still have the unbounded input stream, you have the computation, you have some output, and here we also now learn what these colors mean. Because so in a stateful stream processing system, instead of just looking at this one event that is coming in, you also have some API or some facility for having state in the computation. So this might be a running sum, or this might be a machine learning model that you update based on the incoming events, some stuff that you learn. You can update the state, you can retrieve the state when you do the processing. And usually in these, it's not necessary, but a lot of systems do this. Usually they only provide, or let's say they partition the stream by a given key, for example, the user ID and so on, and they also partition the state by the same key so that they can route events with the same key to the same machine so that state is kept local. Because you could also envision a system where state is global. Basically, you just access a database from your streaming computation. But if you have this, we can't go into detail here, but then you can run into all kinds of problems with consistency, because you somehow need to synchronize the accesses to the state. Because if you have, for example, two parallel computations processing data for the same key and then they update the state, then it's tricky to figure out who goes first. This is updated now, what do I see, and so on. And that's why these systems typically partition the state by key. And basically the key here would be the color of this data, these shapes. And then the last extension is event-time stateful stream processing. And there we extend this thing, so we have unbounded streams, we have state that we keep, and we also have timers, or basically a way of dealing with time that takes into account this event time thing that I was talking about. And timers are essentially a special kind of state. So a computation could say, I'm seeing this event now. Notify me when the event time, so the time in the actual data has processed to this time, because then I want to do some computation. So an example of this, go back to my trusty mobile gaming example, is let's say the first event comes in after a while of inactivity. You take this event, you put it in the state because at some later point you want to retrieve this again because you want to do some processing. And what you do is you register a timer with the system, basically as a session timeout timer, because at that time you want to maybe do some processing or some other stuff. So it's a toy example. But after you've done this, there's more events that are coming in. The user is playing. You put these events also in this state abstraction. And then at some point, the system notices that event time has reached the point at which I earlier set this timer. And how systems deal with event time is usually, or with watermarks. So Google made this popular in the Millwheel paper, and Google Dataflow has this, Beam has this, but it's more of an implementation detail, if you will. But the watermark is basically a notion that tells you, if you have a watermark of timestamp t, for example, this tells you that there should be no more data with timestamps lower than t. So it's a notion of completeness of the stream. But of course, a watermark can never be absolutely correct, because there might always be later that is data that is even later than the watermark. But the watermark is a heuristic that tells you now event time has catched up with some certainty to this point. And then the timer fires, and then you compute some result for the session with all the events or all the stuff that you have put in state, and then you delete the state, because otherwise you would have state leak, if you will, or memory leak, because the state would fill up forever and you would never clean it up, and then the system would go bust at some point. So to summarize this, stateful stream processing basically needed when results depend in some way on the history of the events that you have seen so far. And an important thing to look for in stream processing systems is the tools that they have for dealing with state. Because the problem with state is, or basically the other way around, if you simply have a stream processing system that doesn't have state, it's cheap. You process incoming data, you produce outputs, but when you want to update your system, you just shut it down, update to a new version, start it up again, because you have no state. If you have terabytes of state flying around in the system somewhere, the system needs to have features for dealing with that. So in case of machine failures, it needs to recover that state. If you want to update your code, or if you want to update the system that you're using, somehow there needs to be a path to keep that state and to keep the application running and to deal with that. So we'll get that in a second, but that's, in my opinion, one of the most important things to look for in a stream processing system, what the features are that it provides for dealing with all that state flying around. So now we actually get to Flink. A quick show of hands, who has heard of Flink? Because you saw the sign on the door? That was, okay, that's quite a lot actually. Nice, but to quickly reiterate what Flink is, it's basically three layers. So at the bottom is the distributed stream processing runtime. So this is what basically can take a specification of a stream processing job and execute it on a cluster of machines. So there would be worker nodes that sit around in the cluster. There's a master node that we call job manager. This can take user programs and then spread out the application on the cluster on these worker nodes, on these task managers. And this is also what worries about fault tolerance and all these other kinds of things. So that's the bottom layer. On top of this, we have APIs for stream processing and also for batch processing. So batch processing is mostly a special case of stream processing, if you will. And then on top of this, we have libraries for specific use cases. So there's a library for doing SQL style queries on top of streams, for example, if you want. That's called the Table API. There's a library for machine learning, there's a library for graph processing, and so on. And the distributed runtime, as I mentioned, is responsible for the distributed execution of a program. It provides these basic building blocks for stateful stream processing applications, deals with fault tolerance. There's some very powerful tools for dealing with state, and this is also where the event time awareness happens, where the watermarks are computed and propagated and so on. The programming model, if you write a Flink job, it's I think all the modern stream processing systems have basically the same model, so there can be sources, which is where data comes into the system. This is then connected to several computations. We sometimes call them transformations. They transform these streams of data, and then the results of this are written to a sink, basically. That's the basic idea of the programming model. Just that's the only slide that has code and some stuff. So the API is more or less this distributed collections style of API, where you can basically, you have a data stream which represents a distributed collection or an infinite stream. You apply transformations on this to get other data streams, and then at some point you add a sink. So in this example, we have the environment is what you use to basically set job properties and so on, and to create sources. So we do this, we create a source. Then we apply this map operations, which is basically one event in, one event out. So this parses the data, because the data coming from Kafka might just be a string. Then we have another transformation here, which is a more interesting transformation. It's a windowed transformations, windowed transformation. So a lot of times in stream processing, if you want to do aggregation style computations, you need to induce windows. So basically, a stream is infinite. And if you, for example, want to compute the average of an infinite stream, you would wait until infinity. So what you do is say, compute the average over 1 hour, or here in this case, 5 seconds, because then you have basically a fixed starting time and a fixed end time. And the important bit here is also to consider event time, again, when you specify these windows and when you compute these windows. And here what we say is, let's key the stream by the ID, which might be a user ID, have a window of 5 seconds, and then do some aggregation. And this we write out to something. And what Flink does basically is from these API calls, it creates a graph of operations. So you see this here, there's the source, there's the map, there's the keyword window and reduce, and there's the sink. And Flink can then parallelize this and execute it on these worker nodes, these task managers, on a cluster. So in a nutshell, that's what Flink does. A quick word on where Flink would sit in an actual stack. So you have, imagine you have all these sources, these black boxes here. You somehow collect them into Kafka, because Kafka is very common nowadays, and it's a often used message bus, if you will. This stores all the events so that other systems can consume the data from Kafka and analyze it. And then you can have several, you can have a Flink application that has its application state, and it can output the analyses, the results of these analyses to different systems, to HFS, to Cassandra, and so on. An important thing is if you want to check out Flink and look at this eventful stream processing with time, so you might remember this pretty picture. The API in Flink that you would use for that is the process function. So this is a very low-level building block that basically has methods that are called when data comes in. It has an API that allows you to deal with state, update state, query state, and it has an API for setting timers and reacting to these timers firing. So if you want to look at that, process function is the thing to look at. Then the last thing I want to talk about is operational issues. That sounds very broad, but basically my opinion is that most of the stream processing systems, so if you take Spark Streaming, if you take Apex, if you take Flink, the APIs look mostly the same. So if you squint, that example of Flink code can look like Spark code. You also see this flat map, you have sources, sinks, and so on. Apex has a similar API. And you can express mostly the same things with these APIs. But in my opinion, the point that differentiates these stream processing systems or these systems is the operational issues. So usually what we see is that writing that program, doing a POC, can be done very quickly. But then actually bringing that application into production, so having it run in your system, making it reliable, making it scalable, and so on, that's the hard part. And that's where the systems differentiate themselves. And basically, the questions that people have or that they should look at when considering these stream processing systems is A, how can I run my program, basically? So what kind of cluster do I need? What system do I need? Is that Yarn? Is that Kubernetes? What is it? So how can I actually run it? And not just as a toy example on my laptop, and so on. Another important thing is what happens in case of failures. So if you have all the state flying around, some people have terabytes of state in their Flink applications, what happens in case of failures? How does the system deal with these failures? Another important thing is streaming programs. They very different from batch jobs, which basically run nightly or maybe several times a day, where you can easily update the program in between these batch runs, or you can update the system. A streaming program is running 24/7, basically. And here the question is, what happens if there is some bug in the program? If you want to update your code, if you change something because you find out that you have to do things differently, what can you do while still maintaining that state and not losing that state that you have accumulated? And of course, if you want to update Flink, what happens? Also, an interesting question is, what if I need to migrate my application to a different cluster? Because, for example, I find out that my cluster is not big enough, my company has grown too much, there's too much data coming in. What I thought initially would be enough for the input load is not enough anymore. So what can you do to migrate this state to a new cluster, keeping the program running, and so on? These are, I think that's one of the most important slides, actually, because these are the important questions that you have to ask. And in Flink, basically, the answer is currently you can run Flink on Yarn, so that would be in a Hadoop cluster, for example. There is some preliminary work for running it on Mesos and also for running it on Docker and Kubernetes. And some people are running it on production on Docker because they hacked their own thing, but we are working on making that easier. And in Flink, there's these FLIPs, we call them. It's Flink Improvement Proposal. These are basically proposals or design documents for bigger changes to the systems. And FLIP 6 is a design proposal about updating or refactoring the way the distributed runtime works. So how it allocates resources, for example, from Yarn, how it runs on Mesos, making it easier to run in container environments, and so on. And the keyword here is more dynamic resource allocation also. So for example, in Yarn, you can on the fly give back resources to Yarn or request more resources. And the Flink application should dynamically adapt to the workload and acquire more resources if it needs them, or give away resources to save money if it doesn't need them. So you can already do this in Flink, but it's not as easy as one would like it. So that's one area where a lot of work is going on. I think the most important work, because as I said, the operations issues are the most important issues in my view. Some quick words about how Flink deals with failure handling. So this is very high level, but basically, or let's say, I mentioned there's the job manager, which is basically the coordinating component in a Flink cluster. And for this, we use Zookeeper to make it highly available, so you can have standby job managers. If one fails, it can pick up where the other one failed, basically. And for persisting the state, that would be in these task managers, which are the worker nodes, there are periodic checkpoints of the whole state to HDFS or S3 or some other distributed file system. And in case of failure, we can roll back the application state to a persistent checkpoint from before. That's how the state is made fault tolerant. And the last thing I want to mention is save points. So I talked about how you can deal with version upgrades or with updates of Flink or with migrations of an application to a different cluster. And right now the solution in Flink is save points. So save points allow you to make a persistent copy of the complete state while an application is running to HDFS. Then you can shut down the application, and then in between update the Flink version or update your application or upscale the cluster or downscale the cluster, and then you can restore the application from that save point, and you can pick off where the old application stopped and it still has all the state in there. So we're almost there. So my basic claim, if you will, is if you want to do IoT processing, you need a stream processing system. You need to have fault-tolerant state, because you need, when processing events, you need to have some idea about what happened before that. You need to have event time handling, because data can or it will arrive out of order, and the actual time in the data is important. And the most important thing is stateful stream processors, they need to have the right tools for dealing with that state. As I said, version upgrades, fault tolerance, migration to different clusters, all these kinds of things are very important when you run streaming applications in production. And Flink has good answers to that, and people are working hard on making these answers even better, so that's why I think Flink is a good solution for IoT use cases, basically. So we're hiring, of course. If you're interested in Flink and want to come to Berlin, there's Flink Forward in September. Call for submissions is open. If you're interested, you can look that up. Just Google it, Flink Forward Berlin. And yeah, that's it for me. If you're interested, go check out flink.apache.org. There you can find all the documentation. There you can find links to the mailing lists if you want to get engaged, if you want to try things out, if you want to report issues, and so on. Thank you.